Succession, number 28804, Real Fool.
And others, realising my plight, and the train reverberated to the strains of two old ladies locked in the lavatory. There they sat from Sunday to Saturday. Unfortunately, my escort pushed me into the carriage before mine, and, amidst much hilarity, I was pulled out of the window head first and retrieved bodily by my companions and returned to my rightful place.
And all this wearing a tight skirt.
I was in ATS uniform, yes, yes. Terrible, terrible. At midday, we were pulled into a siding for 3 hours. No refreshments available to allow King Farouk and his entourage to travel back to Cairo from Alexandra in his personal train. He had priority, and in all that heat, the wait seemed interminable. Consequently, we were very late and very tired when we reached Cairo and the Continental Hotel for the night. It was near the famous Shepherd's Hotel, which had been destroyed by fire and burnt to the ground a few months earlier.
So we'll stop this reel and then take it up on the next one. This is Barbara Hammond, Reel 4. So we've got you to Cairo, and you've stayed overnight in a hotel in Cairo. And was it at this point that you found out where you were going next?
Yes, then of course I had to meet the ATS commander in Cairo, who gave me my marching orders. And they said I was to be in sole charge of Palestine ATS in a large military hospital in Tel El Kebir. That was situated in the desert and opposite the Sweetwater Canal. 90 miles from Cairo and 30 miles from Ismailia. I would be accommodated in the officers' mess, 50% English doctors and 50% Jewish, but was to have my own bedroom in the sisters' quarters in which to sleep, as I would be the only female officer attached to the medical staff. When I arrived, I was warmly received and was also introduced to Umberto, an Italian living in the POW camp nearby. He was to be my batman, and he looked after me like a nanny. He had not been back to Italy for 10 years, having first been fighting in Abyssinia and then against us until he was captured by our troops in the Middle East.
Now, you had a couple of stories about Umberto.
Oh, yes, he was lovely. He used to come and wake me up in the mornings with early morning tea. And he was always very delicate, but he used to pull the sheets down and put his finger on my chest and say, "Gula, gula, 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 missy," which meant tea. He never, ever made any passes. He was just so sweet. We always tried to talk to each other in broken English. And one day he came and said, "Sister, my sister, you like, and handed a photo of her. Well, bless his heart, she was ever so big and fat, and she must have been years older than me, and she wasn't all that attractive, and he was absolutely thrilled because he thought we looked alike. You can imagine, that wasn't my day, but he was so sweet. And I must also tell you that when the next year I had to go home because my mother was very ill, he did my packing. And when I eventually arrived back in England and undid my kit bags, there were four heavy black WD blankets. He thought I might be very, very chilly in the English weather, and he thought this was the last thing he could do for my comfort. Bless his heart. Actually, of course, he'd stolen them, hadn't he?
Did you ever find out what happened to him later? Did he manage to get home? Or?
I'm sure he did. Oh, yes, he would have done. He would have done. And I don't think I gave him a photo of myself to show his sister. But he was so sweet. And he and some of his colleagues in the POW camp also have made me two of the most beautiful wooden boxes. One was of different woods, and it was really very lovely. I mean, it was worth a lot of money. It was absolutely perfectly done, and when I got it back home, I gave that one to my father for cigars, and it went on until about 2 years ago. And the other one was oak, slightly smaller, and it had a musical box inside. How they got all those materials, I don't know. And I had that until about 10 years ago, when I gave it to a young friend, a little girl, because she wanted a musical box. But they were so lovely, really, so many of them.
What sort of general duties would a Batman be doing for a lady officer? Would it be basically?
Well,
the
he
same
wasn't
thing?
Just doing mine. He was taking my laundry, because we had I've forgotten his name now, but he did the laundry every day. You had to have all your stuff done, probably two uniforms and underwear and all sorts of things, and he'd take them to the chap, I suppose another Italian who did the washing, and then brought them back to my room, and he'd make my bed, and he'd turn it up, and if I needed anything to do with my uniform, he would do it for me. And he was just generally there. I felt sorry for him, because I think he was so homesick. Well, he must have been after 10 years. I couldn't understand whether he had a wife or not, but I don't think he did. I think it was his sister he was more interested in.
Did he do things like cooking for you?
Oh, no.
Did you
eat? I would definitely in the mess. I was a member of the mess, you see. It was only that my bedroom was just discreetly just inside the sister's thing. Otherwise, they might have thought I might have wandered.
They didn't trust you.
Well, perhaps they didn't trust the other officers either. I had a wonderful time. So I used to go out every night, sometimes for three different do's. One would be go and have supper somewhere, then go on to a dance, and then sometimes something at about 2 a.m. It was a wonderful life, but I was worn out.
But what time did you start work the next day?
About 11:30. Half past eight.
In the morning?
Yes, but I was always last in the mess for breakfast. But then I was very good, because I worked in the afternoons and all of them went to sleep, including my ATS. But I went working so that I could enjoy the nights. When I got back home, my mother looked askance and said, "Your eyes are very black," she said, "and you've got little pouches." And I think it must have been because I was having such a good time.
Too many late nights and
too many nights. Yes, too many late nights.
So I was actually going to ask you about what it was like at night, but not from the point of view of nightlife. It was more from the point of view, did it get cooler? Or did you have trouble with the insects?
It certainly got
at night?
Cooler, and in the autumn it got quite chilly. Yes, it did. But you wore civvies. And of course, in the winter and the sort of December and January, you wore a jacket as well.
Did you have much trouble with insects or in the evenings?
You were always having to have things for mosquito bites and all sorts of things. Oh, yes. And then there were other very big insects that could be very nasty.
And did very you have, nasty. Did they give you inoculations before you actually left?
Oh, yes, definitely. And another thing I was always told, directly I was in the Middle East, that I must be very, very careful. We were all told we must be very, very careful if we took taxis, never to go with more than just the driver.
Yes, of course. We'll come back to that in a second. Yes. Because that led to quite a story.
Yes.
But in general, then, you got used to the climate after a while.
I was always absolutely soaked through at lunchtime. So I used to go back to the mess, and we all used to have drinks and drinks and drinks. You know, we were so dehydrated.
Mm-hmm. And was it basically water? Or?
Well, it was anything, really. But, I mean, I certainly didn't have spirits midday. Mm-hmm. I did sometimes have eggnog. I don't know why I did. But it was mostly things like, well, I suppose the chaps had beer, but I had something, because you just had glass after glass of it. Because I did work quite hard in the heat. I did work quite hard.
Brings me to another question about latrines, for want of a better word. If you're drinking all this water, how are the lavatorial facilities?
Well, they were latrines mostly. But we had, I think we had, as far as I remember, we had in the mess an inside one. But most of all the other ones you see that were under canvas, they had latrines. And sheds.
Mm-hmm. And from the point of view of showers, did you have access to showers
yes.
on a regular basis?
Yes, in the mess.
Warm water?
No.
Cold water?
More or less. I mean, it wasn't luxurious at all, not a bit.
I mean, that's all very well when the weather's nice and hot, but when it was colder, that must have been quite something.
Not so good, no. Mm. No. But it was also exciting, really. I loved it.
So you didn't suffer from sleep deprivation or anything from all these wild nights out?
No, it was a question of keeping awake. Very often. But it was wonderful. I was so lucky, really.
And you didn't sort of succumb to any of the local diseases? Or?
I think I had gypsy tummy once for a couple of days. But otherwise, I knew what I did have. I went with one of my escorts. We went up to, because we used to go up to, if I went up to London, I mean to Cairo, for a day or two, we nearly always stayed at the Continental Hotel. But on one occasion, I was with somebody. It wasn't a real boyfriend, but we went up there together. And we couldn't get into the Continental Hotel. So he found a very, very nice bed and breakfast owned by Egyptians near the hotel, and we had separate rooms. And I remember when I got into bed, about 1 in the morning, I thought, God, I can't bear this, because it was a straw palace. And then we went back down to Tel El Kebir the next day, and he was going on from me to the Kassassin holding unit, because he was going home. And I had a great friend in the mess. Well, I had three or four that were great friends. When I got back, I went to one of them and said, look, I'm absolutely in agony with the most awful bites all around my neck. He said, you've got a very rare thing from a certain insect in that straw. It took me several days, and it was agonizing. So you see, you did get things, and you see, you never would have got that at the Continental Hotel. But you see, it looked clean, it looked quite nice, mm-hmm. but there you are. Mm.
So it's quite handy being working in a hospital.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And the other thing, of course, was we had quite a lot of patients, not necessarily army patients, but civilian patients, you know, Egyptians. Their driving wasn't very good, any of them. They were hopeless drivers, and they went like mad. And, of course, when we got out of the hospital, we went onto the main road, which was it winded a lot. Mm. And it was only a yard or two from the Sweetwater Canal. So often they lost their vision or something went wrong, and they would land up in the Sweetwater Canal. And then they had to come back into the hospital. It was a very nasty thing they had to do. They had to have a series of injections into the stomach, and it was called Bilharzia, the drug. And I had a girl that had come up from Yugoslavia. She was a Fanny, and she'd been in headquarters. What was his name then? Yugoslavia.
Tito.
Tito. Yes, she was in Tito's office in Yugoslavia. She was a Fanny, and she was on her way home, and she had to stop off because she got Bilharzia. I don't know how it happened. And I went to see her in the ward, and she was having those injections, and they were terrible. So that, and then of course there were other tropical diseases, they came in, and just ordinary things, you know, that people had, like pregnancy or surgery.
So it's the full range.
Yes. But mostly I think army personnel, mostly, that were patients.
Because that was my next question, really, was about just your everyday duties and the sort of everyday routines that you might have come across.
Well, my Palestinian ATS were largely those who had fled from various countries in Europe, such as Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, France, etc. Many had lost their parents, brothers or sweethearts in that dreadful purge of the Jews by the Nazis. One of my ATS had witnessed the shooting of both her parents, but had managed to escape. It was difficult for me to converse with those very brave and often grief-stricken women, owing to the language difficulties, as none could speak English and very few Hebrew. But my sergeant, Ruth, who was absolutely excellent and such a lovely girl, her father was a don at the university in Jerusalem. She knew Hebrew, so she was able to converse more easily with most of them. My ATS lived in tents within the perimeter of the hospital. Some had degrees and were really very highly educated, but they were allocated to work in the pathologist laboratory and similar departments, as well as in other departments. In fact, many were very highly trained. I was, of course, quite a difficult task, really, in charge of their pay and discipline. But somehow I managed to, we had a sort of wonderful understanding, and we all became very great friends. And I was able to cope with the, how shall I say, communication difficulties. Sometimes it was difficult, but by and large, it was a very happy year I spent there.
And while you were there, obviously the war ended.
The Japanese war ended. As far as I remember, it was on the 14th of August, 1945.
And do you remember any celebrations?
Oh, yes, we had parties in the mess and that sort of thing. But nothing like VE Day. Mm-hmm. Nothing like VE Day. And especially the Jewish ones, they just wanted to leave the mess and go back to their homes, you know, and celebrate there. But I know I went out on one or two things that night. But it was nothing like VE Day.
Mm. And I never asked you about VE Day, how you celebrated that.
I was in Egham.
Because you were at the college, weren't you?
We were just finishing that day, and we had 2 days off. And we all went out that first night, just out in the streets, you know, like everybody did, dancing and having food and music, you know, and just general sort of And then the next day, I remember two of us or three of us walked for miles in the fields outside Acombe. We went to a pub and we walked. And I think that evening, I'd picked up a master from a prep school nearby, and yes, I think I had an evening out with him, as far as I remember. I think I met him once or twice afterwards when I got back home before I went off to the Middle East, and that was it. He was a lot older than me anyway, but that was the sort of thing. And everybody was just so overjoyed. It was so sad for those that had just lost, perhaps only the day before, one of their nearest and dearest. That was all so sad. But there was the other side that was so wonderful, really. But it must have been quite something in London, especially in Trafalgar Square. And I wasn't there because I was down there.
But VGA Day, it was just a completely different atmosphere.
Oh, yes. Hardly any celebrations at all, really.
Mm. What do you think the feeling was overall? Was it just relief? Or?
Well, you see, don't forget, they were a long way from Japan, weren't they? And I think it's so true that you often heard that Burma and Japan were the forgotten armies. Do you remember that? Mm. Well, that was true. And I think they had the most terrible time because my brother-in-law was there. And he was actually there with Pearl Harbor. And he was a civilian. He'd been out there for about 30 years. He'd been there when he was very young. And he was then, he'd been in World War I at 17 with his twin brother for 1 year. He put his age down, at least age forward, and both of them got back, but they were in the First World War for 1 year. And then in his 90s, when he was in his 20s, he went up to Hong Kong to live, and he became a civilian. And during that time, he became a captain in the Territorial Army, you know, British Territorial Army. So he was about 45 then, and my sister was 15 years younger than him, and she had two young children in Hong Kong. And about 2 months before Pearl Harbor, he was very astute, and he was always certain that the Japs would invade and that it wouldn't be for very long. So he took my sister and the two children, son and daughter, by ship to Australia, to Melbourne, and it was two months later when, of course, he was captured in uniform, you see. So he was a POW, not in a camp, and he had quite a rough time, but he did know the lingo, so he was able to converse with most of the guards. Some of them were quite good, but others weren't, and he had a pretty ghastly time. And for 2 years, my sister in Melbourne didn't know whether he was alive or dead. But he did get a lot of alarm call. He had a lot of, after 2 years, I think it was, he had the Red Cross, or a year or so, he had the Red Cross parcels. Mm-hmm. And he used to, through the guards that he knew, get them over to his civilian friends in the camp. Mm-hmm. And then he had all his teeth bashed out by, I think, a Jap guard, by his rifle. And at the end of it all, he got the British Empire, BEM, you know, British Empire Medal. And then, of course, he was released directly. It was all over. But he was there about 3 years.
That must have been tough for you as well, knowing that he was there.
Well, it was terribly tough for his wife. Mm. Terribly tough, wasn't it? And it must have been awful for him. Not sure if his parents were still alive. I think they were. Must have been terrible for them, because they lived in Wales. Shall I go and do
I'll
that?
Just pause this.
And okay. That
yes,
well, read on my...
Yes. We're going to end this reel now because there's a section coming up on some of the dangers that you had to face while you were in the Middle East. And I think that there are three specific episodes that you're going to talk about. So I'll start a fresh reel for those.